From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
I'm from Cleveland Heights.
West Oakland, California.
I think my landlord marketed it to me as Temescal, but it's actually Golden Gate.
Coming up, two propositions on the ballot have to do with plastic bags. Environmental groups say one of them was made to confuse you.
Voters are being used in this sense to try and detract attention away from the proposition that is the most important and will have the most impact, which is ban plastic bags.
Then, speaking of confusing, we'll test your knowledge of municipal finance.
Do you think the public understands bonds?
No.
And how going through a late friend's personal archives led one artist to a revelation.
It was in that moment that I went, wow, somebody has to make a show about this guy.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Californians will be voting on not one, but two plastic bag propositions next week. One of them, Proposition 67, will ban plastic bags statewide. Environmental groups and grocery stores support it. The other one, Prop 65, requires that the 10 cents you pay for paper or reusable bags go to an environmental fund. The plastic bag industry supports this one. If you're confused, some people say that's by design. Here to help us sort it all out is KALW's Marissa Ortega Welch.
Have a good one. Thank you. Hi. How are you? Got everything okay?
In most Bay Area grocery stores, you can't get plastic bags anymore. San Francisco, Alameda County, most of Marin, they've all banned the bag. To find a grocery store giving out plastic bags for free, I had to drive to a Lucky in San Ramon.
Plastic's okay?
Laura also came to San Ramon for the free bags. She doesn't want to give her last name because she's the manager of a local store. She lives in Dublin, right next door to San Ramon, but across the county line, where they do have a bag ban.
You have to pay for bags in Dublin.
Okay.
Which is why I come to Lucky's and not Safeway.
So you purposefully shop on your way home.
Exactly.
So that
exactly.
You can go to the store that has plastic bags.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. So I don't have to worry about juggling all my items.
Or she could bring her own bags. That's what Tamara Armendariz usually does. She and her daughter are also shopping at Lucky today. Like Laura, they live the next town over, in Dublin, but they support the bag ban. They just forgot to bring their reusable bags in from the car. Tamara's daughter pushes the cart with plastic bags full of groceries through the parking lot.
Yeah, so there are the bags that we're supposed to use.
Yeah, see, here's my bags.
If Prop 67 passes, Tamara might be walking back to her car to get those bags she forgot. Under Prop 67, single-use plastic bags will be banned statewide. Grocery stores will sell paper bags or reusable thicker plastic bags for 10 cents, basically how it is in most of the Bay Area now.
I think it's smart. You know, it's just people like me who leave the bags in the trunk, and then I'll have to take a few extra steps, come back to my car, get my bag.
Or she could pay the 10 cents. The 10 cents is part of what's at issue here. But a second proposition on the ballot, Prop 65, would send that 10 cents to a state fund for environmental projects, instead of letting grocery stores keep the money.
I like the other one. I like the second one. What was that, 65?
Yep, Prop 65. It's confusing. And some people say that's on purpose. Prop 65 was put on the ballot by the plastic bag industry. It doesn't actually create a bag ban. It just says if there is a bag ban, then the 10-cent bag fee should go to an environmental fund.
Really?
Environmental groups are actually telling people to vote no. That's because they think the plastic bag industry created Prop 65 to confuse voters.
It seems pretty typical. There's always somebody trying to confuse us out here.
And that's the whole point of Prop 65, actually.
This is Allison Chan from the environmental group Save the Bay. They support the Prop 67 bag ban and are against Prop 65.
Voters are being used in this sense to try and detract attention away from the proposition that is the most important and will have the most impact, which is ban plastic bags across California.
California already has a statewide plastic bag ban. Jerry Brown signed it into law in 2014.
Finally, after many years of trying, we got a bill passed and the governor signed it, and yay, California banned the bag.
But the plastic bag industry wanted to put a stop to it. So they gathered enough signatures to put the bag ban on the ballot as a referendum. That means voters have to decide if they want to keep or repeal the law.
And so now this November, that referendum is on the ballot as Prop 67, and it means that voters will have to make the final decision.
If Prop 67 passes, Jerry Brown's bill will go into effect. Free plastic bags will be banned in grocery stores statewide. Environmental groups and grocer associations want you to vote yes on Prop 67. But the plastic bag industry also put Prop 65 on the ballot. It says that the 10 cents customers pay for alternative bags should go to an environmental fund. Remember how Prop 67 is a referendum? Well, referendums always go last. So Californians have to vote on Prop 65 before they get to Prop 67 on the ballot.
Because 65 comes before 67, it's likely to confuse voters into thinking that I voted for something having to do with plastic bags. I must have done my part, even for voters who want to support the bag ban.
But why don't environmental groups want us to vote yes for Prop 65 and Prop 67?
There has been some question about whether or not both of them passing could put Prop 67 in some kind of jeopardy.
Time to pull out that phone book-sized voter guide you got in the mail. The way Prop 65 was written, it could be interpreted to cancel out the Prop 67 bag ban if Prop 65 gets more votes. That's why environmental groups like Save the Bay and the Surfrider Foundation are asking people to vote no on Prop 65.
John Barrier, I'm a spokesperson for the American Progressive Bag Alliance.
I called John Barrier at his Sacramento office. He represents the plastic bag industry. It has invested $6 million to defeat the Prop 67 bag ban and pass Prop 65.
The intent, 100%, is to make sure that this money is redirected.
He thinks if the grocery stores are going to charge extra for a bag, the money should go toward the environment.
The most egregious part of Proposition 67 or Senate Bill 270 as it was passed is the transfer of wealth from California consumers, folks who visit the grocery store, from their pockets to the pockets of corporate grocery chains.
Barrier says the only reason why grocery stores are supporting the Prop 67 bag ban is because they can stand to profit.
This is an issue that is very plainly about money. It's about the grocery stores and the California Grocers Association, their lobbying arm, looking for a way, under the guise of environmentalism, to reap more profits.
Grocery stores disagree. Steve Maviglio is a spokesperson for the Yes on 67 campaign.
And I'll also put another hat on. I'm on the board of directors of the Sacramento Natural Foods Co-op.
Some of the biggest contributors to the Yes on 67 campaign are grocery stores, Albertsons, the California Grocers Association, and Ralph's. But still,
the notion that this is somehow some kind of massive profit center, it's just there's no foundation in fact for that.
Maviglio says the 10 cents that grocery stores charge for paper or reusable bags barely covers the cost.
Our grocery store, for example, we're still losing 4 to 6 cents per bag even when we charge 10 cents.
So why would grocery stores bankroll a bag ban? Maviglio says it got confusing for the big grocery chains like Albertsons and Lucky to have a store in one town with a bag ban and a store in another town without one. Finally, the stores threw up their hands and said,
okay, let's have statewide regulation instead of town-by-town regulation.
Maviglio says the plastic bag industry created Prop 65 to get back at the grocery stores for supporting the Prop 67 bag ban. So while grocers and plastic bag companies duke it out, voters like Tamara have to decide how they're going to vote.
I've been reading up on a lot of them and finding out who supports what.
Right. Yeah, it is really important to notice who's supporting what.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is.
Okay, Tamara and voters, here's the recap. Environmental groups and grocery stores want you to vote no on Prop 65 and yes on Prop 67. This would ban single-use plastic bags across the state. The plastic bag industry wants you to vote the opposite. Yes on Prop 65 and no on Prop 67. This would strike down the statewide bag ban. Easy, right? It's in the bag. From San Ramon, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
If you're overwhelmed by this year's massive ballot, don't worry, we've got your back. Head to our website, kalw.org, to find all sorts of election coverage to keep you informed, including two-minute briefs on all 17 of the propositions. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. So you just heard a story about how hard voters have to work to fully understand the things they're voting on. You know what else leaves us confused? Municipal bonds. Look at your ballot this November or any election season, and you'll see the word bond all over it. This time around, Oakland is voting on Measure KK, a bond to fix up streets and community buildings. And San Franciscans are voting on Proposition A, a bond to repair and rehabilitate school facilities. They'll both cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and voters all over the Bay are voting on Measure RR, the $3.5 billion bond to patch up BART. This seems like a good time to ask some basic questions, like what is a municipal bond and what happens if one passes? KLW's economics reporter Jeremy Dalmas wants you to be informed.
It's election season. So, of course, I'm at the Bar El Rio in San Francisco doing what everyone loves to do over a beer, chat about municipal bonds. Do you know what a bond is?
No, but do you want me to guess?
Do you know what a bond is?
No, I don't.
I'm unclear about what exactly they are. I know bonds deal with how state and local governments spend and pay for things that can cost millions, sometimes billions of dollars. Remember how Vallejo and Stockton went bankrupt? That's partially because of having to pay for bonds. But beyond that, it gets hazy. How about you? Do you understand municipal bonds? I'll give you a few seconds to think about it. Okay, we'll check back in a few minutes to see how you did. It looks like I'm probably not going to figure out what a bond is at this bar. I think we need a bond nerd to help us out.
My name is Mark Jaffe. I'm an independent public policy researcher focused on municipal finance.
Jaffe has worked with UC Berkeley's Haas Business School and with Moody's. They're the people that rate how risky bonds are. My first question for him, what the heck is a bond?
Well, a bond is a way of paying for something over a long period of time. So if we're going to build a school, we're going to get the benefit of that school for many, many years. So it doesn't seem reasonable in a way to just pay that all at once. And so maybe the school will last for 30 years, and over the same 30-year period, we're paying for the bond.
Okay, not as complicated as I thought. We're not done yet, though. But first, how did El Rio patron Dominique Piccinino do?
I know it has to do with money, and that it's not, like, all the money's not there right away. It's like an IOU kind of a thing.
It is kind of like an IOU. A bond is similar to a loan. Except for a loan, you usually walk into a single big institution, like a bank, and borrow the money from them. Bonds, on the other hand, are broken up into lots of little pieces of debt, and people come buy those pieces from you at a bond sale. Do you want part of San Francisco's debt? Do you want a very safe investment that doesn't make you a lot of money, but you don't have to pay income tax on? Then a bond is for you. Okay, so once the city sells these bonds and borrows this huge chunk of money, how are they going to pay it back? Well, there are two ways. Firstly, there are the less common revenue bonds. They pay for themselves.
So for example, let's say we want to build a bridge, and the bridge is going to generate toll revenue. That toll revenue will go to finance the bonds.
The Golden Gate Bridge itself was funded with a revenue bond.
After 5 years of work, the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge is completed. The world's longest single-span suspension bridge that cost over £7 million.
But mostly, you're probably going to see what are called general obligation bonds on the ballot. These bonds will be paid for by taxpayers, usually with property taxes. They fund big projects like fixing up school buildings, water systems, and roads. At El Rio, Leticia Huerta was close, but she missed the mark.
A bond measure or allocating money for schools is done through bond measures. I don't know. Oh, God. I don't know.
Well, Leticia, you would pay to build a new school or fix the roof of an old one with a general obligation bond. But you're not going to use one to pay for day-to-day things like teachers' salaries. And getting into the details of exactly how much a property owner will end up paying in property taxes is complicated. Take Prop A on the November 2008 ballot in San Francisco. It was a bond to help update the San Francisco General Hospital. If it had failed, no fixing up the hospital, no extra taxes. But it passed, meaning if you own a building in San Francisco, you will pay, on average, over the next couple decades, about $170 a year if your house is worth $500,000. And in return, you get a freshly renovated hospital. But that $170 is just an average. The actual costs will be different every year.
So when you receive your property tax bill, you'll actually see a line item for the bonds.
By 2014, the city had already sold all the bonds and done all the construction. Now, all the public has to do is use their new hospital as they slowly pay off the debt from now until 2035. Mayor Ed Lee was excited about it at the opening ceremony.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to your hospital.
If you're a renter, don't worry. You'll still end up paying for that hospital, too. In San Francisco, landlords can pass 50% of these property tax increases on to tenants. But on the bright side, all those new condos being built up and down Market Street on empty lots, brand new properties mean brand new property taxes. More money to pay for bonds. And slightly less money that everyone else has to pay.
Do you think the public understands bonds?
No.
If you like getting into the weeds, there are plenty more weeds to get into. There are financial details on your city's website and in your voter guide. But not all of us are municipal bond experts like Mark Joffe.
For people who don't have a financial background or maybe didn't take economics in school or whatever, you know, that's going to be more difficult. So you have to ask the questions, well, do I think $150 more on my property taxes is worth, what it's going to pay for? And how sure am I that the government that's asking for these bonds is really going to spend the money efficiently, effectively, and in the way that they say they're going to spend it?
So how did you do? Did you know what a bond was? One person I talked with at El Rio pretty much got it.
They find the richest people or whatever. It's like they get a loan from like their personal like stash of money because they're rich, right? And then they use that money to like do whatever they want to do, right? And then they have to pay the rich people back with interest or whatever, and then they get taxpayers to do that.
Good job, Allison Fragamini. You win the bond competition. Your prize? Understanding municipal finance. At El Rio, with a beer in hand, this is Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
If you can't get enough stories about municipal bonds, well, we have more for you, believe it or not, including one that takes you inside the room where San Francisco sells its own. Go to klw.org and search for bond auction to find that one. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. San Francisco-based artist Seth Eisen calls himself a transdisciplinary artist. He started out studying traditional visual art, but he now makes performances that mix dance, theater, music, puppetry, and installation. His latest piece celebrates the life and work of another multi-genre artist, his friend Remy Sharlip. Sharlip was a seminal dancer, choreographer, and children's book author who worked with John Cage and Merce Cunningham in New York in the 60s and spent the last two decades of his life here in the Bay Area. The new show Rainbow Logic, arm-in-arm with Remy Sharlip, is the latest in Eisen's growing body of work, spotlighting LGBTQ history in danger of being forgotten. KLW's Jen Sheehan spoke to Seth Eisen about his work and what it's like to make a show about someone you know.
You knew Remy personally because he eventually ended up living here in the Bay Area. Can you talk about your relationship with
him? Yeah, I met Remy in 1991 at Naropa, then Institute, now University. And he
was
in
Boulder,
Colorado. That's in Boulder, Colorado, and it's a university that teaches contemplative education, so meditation and tai chi, yoga, that kind of thing. And Remy was my very first teacher, and I saw him in the catalog, and I thought, wow, he's also a visual artist like me and a performer, dancer, and I loved this sort of interdisciplinary way that he approached his work, that it was about body, it was about image, it was about the space, it was about caring for the body, it was about healing. So I was really intrigued by that. When I moved to the Bay Area, he said, look me up. So I looked him up, and we became close friends. But when he had a stroke in 2005, I lived very close to him and was part of his care circle. And then had the great opportunity of working to help to organize and catalog his archives. So we boxed up, you know, his house and his personal possessions, as well as the archive, which is about 108 boxes, a good Buddhist number.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
So you were very close to Remy after he had his stroke. When did you decide that you wanted to make a piece?
Well, I was tasked with packing up his house and then also putting all of his archives in boxes and then working with this incredible guy named John Hell Jr. To catalog everything he had. So what we did was come up with a 1,000-page document. So I had to go through everything, bring every box to John, and he went through and typed everything out. It was in that moment when I was packing everything up that I had this moment of like, aha, wow, this is incredible. And it wasn't just like just the papers and the contracts for all of his children's books, you know, like 38 children's books. It's a lot of contracts, you know, and drawings and costumes and photos. So it's like history on top of history, 60 some years of being a practicing artist. I thought, somebody has to make a show about this guy. This is incredible. And it was like there was a moment where I sort of like separated with him as my friend and realized that, yeah, this is a person who I quote unquote know, but actually I don't know anything about. That there's 60 years of history I know nothing about before I met him. And it's not just remembering his life. I felt like there were keys that I could share from his wisdom and his legacy that could be helpful not just to me and my friends, but to people at large. Like, he made a lot of discovery, and you know, we take for granted now as performers that like we care for the body and we we do things that are good for ourselves, or we go to therapy or whatever it is to like explore the self and how we can be better people, better humans, better citizens. But Remy was doing that before that was actually a thing.
What were some of the challenges of that, of making a piece about someone that you had a personal relationship, but that you also wanted to make something beyond just a memorial?
Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of, like, I realized I had to sort of step aside and go, yeah, you don't really know anything about this guy.
So not just your memories.
Not just my memories at all.
Conglomeration.
Yeah. But then I became really curious about, wait a minute, what I'm really looking at is how we age and how we die, and then how our legacy is carried on. And I'm just interested in that perspective of, like, what can someone like Remy Sharlip bring to that idea, you know, what wisdom did he leave behind that can help me as a middle-aged man, artist, person, to be able to live more fully and to be able to make more community around me and to make this place, even though it sounds corny, a better place to live in and to enjoy my life. There's plenty of distractions and stress and so forth with surviving as an artist or surviving as a human in our culture. And I look back to my elders and ancestors to be able to give me some clues about, you know, what it is like to actually grow old and have people not look at you anymore, or to be disabled, or to have some of these things in your life experience that are not what we think of as ideal. Like, people don't really want to talk about what happens after a stroke, but it's a reality. And I watched a man who was one of the best visual artists I know lose his ability to be able to draw after writing and illustrating 38 books, after choreographing hundreds of dances for people, not really be able to walk very well. And certainly an incredible communicator, not really be able to speak because he had aphasia. So that in itself was really a very touching experience as a friend, or to be able to witness. And I wanted to share some of what that aging experience is with, not from like a depressing side, but from the point of view of like, this is what happens to us. And then how does our legacy get carried on when you have 108 boxes or more or less, right? Even if it's just one sheet of paper that you leave behind, like what happens to it? Who carries your story on? Are you significant? Have you made your mark?
That was transdisciplinary artist Seth Eisen speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. Seth's show is called Rainbow Logic, Arm in Arm with Remy Sharlip. It opens this Friday at Counterpulse in San Francisco and runs through November 20th. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's our show for today. The team includes Leela Day, Jürgen Klemm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Chris Hoff, Olivia Henry, Jeremy Ju, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Today's show is engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Thank you. This music is by bass player Reed Mathis. He's appearing at Doc's Lab in North Beach this Thursday night and Friday, and both shows start at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.